Greetings, everyone. This is the Click Podcast for Tuesday, the 22nd of April, 2014. And as you're about to hear, we are going to be celebrating 25 years of the World Wide Web. Of course, Bill is here. Hello, Bill. How are you?
I'm very well. Thank you, Gareth.
And we have poet Selina Godden, who is going to grace us with some poetry.
Hello, Gareth. How are you doing?
Exceedingly well, thank you. Looking forward to the poem. And
thank you.
You two might like this story, because I've been asking our listeners on Facebook and on Twitter about their earliest web experiences and what the web means for you and all that kind of stuff. Just to kick us off, Paul Rogers says that he went for a job interview with a science magazine in 1994. And Paul goes on to say, the editor asked me what I thought of this newfangled internet thingy. I waxed lyrical about how it was going to be a paradigm shift. I said it would change everything and that we'd all end up using it. I may even have quoted Canadian media guru Marshall McLuhan. When I'd finished, the editor said he thought basically all this was just a fad. Needless to say, my career in that magazine never got off the ground. Isn't it great to be right, to be proved right?
But you didn't get the job,
did you?
Didn't
get the job,
yes,
exactly.
That's the tragedy.
So the question for Paul is, would he rather have got the job and been wrong, or the other way around? I think I can guess what the answer might be. Ladies and gentlemen, should we have the programme?
That's a very good idea.
Why not?
Hello everyone, welcome to this special edition of Click. I'm Gareth Mitchell, and if you can hear a bit of an echo on my voice, that's because I'm here at CERN, in a very large theatre, the amphitheatre at the centre of the CERN complex. CERN, of course, is the International Physics Lab, where the first clear evidence of the existence of the Higgs boson particle was discovered in the Large Hadron Collider. Now, it's also famous as the home of the World Wide Web, invented here in 1989 by British physicist Tim Berners-Lee. And it's that anniversary that we're marking in this special edition. Well, of course, Bill Thompson is here as well, expert Bill Thompson. And this theatre means something to you as well, doesn't it, Bill?
It does. It's really quite lovely to be back here again, because although the web was invented in March 1989 by Tim, in 1994, the first World Wide Web conference was held in this very room, as they say, at CERN, and I was lucky enough to be one of the 380 people at what we like to call the Woodstock of the Web, the first serious gathering of people who at the time called ourselves web weavers, the people who were trying to make the World Wide Web.
OK, so that was in 1994. It was around May 1994 as well. So what was the outcome? You sat in this very theatre back then as a web weaver. Obviously, we know what happened after that in terms of the World Wide Web and everything that it's done for society. But going back to that particular conference, what happened, and I'm going to banging one of the lecterns here as well, what was the import of that particular meeting?
One thing that came out of it was the announcement of the World Wide Web Consortium, the independent body that Tim Berners-Lee and a few other people pulled together to try to guide the development of the web. So the W3C, as it's called, doesn't make standards. It doesn't set standards for the web, but it makes recommendations that everyone tends to adopt around things like HTML, the hypertext markup language, or HTTP, the hypertext transport protocol. And I think the announcement about the consortium was made at the conference because it was the first time a large number of people who'd been actively developing web technologies came in together in one place. We all realized that we shared a vision for what the web could be as a way of moving information around over the internet. It was clear this wasn't going away. We sort of felt that anyway. But it was also clear there was enough coherence in our thinking, in the thinking of all the people who were involved, many of whom made much greater contributions to it than I ever did, that this was worth investing time and energy in, and that we'd go away from CERN at the end of May, realizing there was a mission.
Is it the case that without that conference, that the web would have happened somehow? Like, we already had the internet, and the web was the set of protocols sitting on top of it that has allowed all the kind of services and ideas that we've become familiar with to happen. Supposing that conference hadn't happened, maybe supposing Tim Berners-Lee and his colleagues here at CERN hadn't come up with the whole idea of HTML, would we have something that even kind of resembled what we now think of as the web?
I think we would, because it was a bit like the invention of calculus by Leibniz and Newton around the same time. There was something in the air in the early 90s. There was this sense that the internet was growing as a network that could ship data around. The number of users was growing. It was becoming available for commercial uses as well as academic and government use. So there was a need for an online information system that sat on top of the internet, used internet protocols, but was more flexible, could be made more user-friendly, and was more more adaptable. And, you know, in the early 90s, the web was one of a number of technologies. There was Gopher, for example, WAIS, the Wide Area Information Service. They were, in a sense, competing with each other. The web took off because CERN agreed with Tim Berners-Lee to make it completely open, not to seek to license the core protocols or the technology, to allow people to develop it, and the others were slightly more closed. So I suspect something would have come into that space. There was a desire and a need for something which could do the things the web has done.
And so the web was born in 1989, and then 5 years later, along came that all-important Woodstock of the web meeting in 1994. 4 years before all that, though, this was in 1990, Hitchhiker's Guide writer Douglas Adams was clearly onto something in his TV drama Hyperland. In a dream, Adams ends up in an encounter with a character played by former Doctor Who actor Tom Baker. As you're about to hear, this was a scenario that was completely far-fetched. I mean, like, this would never actually happen in real life.
Who the hell are you?
My name is Tom, and I'm your agent. May I ask if you know what that means?
You want 15%?
It means that I'm here to do your every slightest bidding, to fetch and carry for you. No job too small or too menial.
Are you sure you mean agent?
I mean that I'm a software agent, and I only exist as what we call an application in your computer. I have the honor to provide instant access to every piece of information stored digitally anywhere in the world. Any picture or film, any sound, any book, any statistic, any fact, any connection between anything you care to think of, you have only to tell me, and it will be my humble duty to find it for you and to present it to you for your interactive pleasure. Is there anything I can do for you now, Mr. Adams, sir?
Well, yes, you can stop being so obsequious for a start.
Yeah, well, in a way, even the obsequiousness became a bit of a reality, didn't it? So, indeed, in the real world, two especially early adopters now take up the story. Author and futurist Mark Pesce, but first, Dame Professor Wendy Hall.
When you think about it, you know, Tim, he put up one, hit the website, and then a few other people copied him and put up websites, and it was very slow to start, and it was a, you know, like a rolling stone gradually gathering moss. And really, when you look back, it's quite remarkable how it happened.
Summer of 1993, I was at a computer graphics conference called SIGGRAPH, and there was this little computer. It was a Silicon Graphics workstation, and it said, "This is the World Wide Web." And I sat down and clicked and clicked and clicked, and I said, "Oh, look, it's a hypertext system." And I'd used hypertext systems before. I was like, "There doesn't seem to be a lot in here, though." And I just sort of dismissed it on the spot. In the space of time between July and October, people had been very busy, and there was now a lot of content. And in fact, I got very excited by this and spent the last week of October in 1993 surfing the web. And by the end of the week, I was done. I had surfed the entire web.
When you look at the graph of the development, it was nearly 10 years after Tim put that first website up until Google emerged. And that was started off as a research paper. Brin and Page published a paper about, you know, a new way of searching the web. And then they had to show that it scaled in engineering terms, and then they had to find a business model to make it work. And it wasn't until, I think, 1999 that the company actually began to emerge, and we started to use that. Do you remember that dramatic change from the search engines then, the Yahoos and the Alta Vistas, which were cluttered with advertising because that was the only way they could think to make them work, to that vanilla Google page where you just typed your search term in and back came the answers? Of course, the thing was that there was already a web there. It would have been very difficult for them to build Google if there hadn't been a web for them to build it on. The way he evolved it, using the network effect, making the standards open and universal and giving it away. I mean, his real legacy is he didn't seek to commercialize it. I mean, it would be a different world, I think, and I often say this to my students, what type of world might it have been if Tim had been like Bill Gates and wanted to make a company out of this? We'd be paying per click, or certainly paying for the software. And Tim's argument was that we can't put any barriers in the way, economic or technical, to stop people using this, because everyone's got to use it or nobody will.
I was giving a talk in 2002 to celebrate Douglas Engelbart, who passed away last year, who was the person who really invented hypertext back in the 1960s. And after I gave my little talk, which was about the importance of knowledge sharing, I walked off stage and someone leaned to me and said, "Hey, have you heard of this thing called Wikipedia?" And at the time, Wikipedia was very small, and it wasn't really that interesting, but you could tell, like the web, that when even when it was small and not all that interesting, that it had enormous potential. And I think what it showed was this capacity that we have as a species to pool our knowledge and to make something amazing out of that shared knowledge, that now basically everyone who's connected to the internet, so 2.5 billion people, have access to the collected knowledge of humanity and can use all of that to make better decisions for themselves and for their lives.
So those early web weavers wanted the web to be a free kind of place. But in the present day, in 2014, how likely might people be to know the name of web inventor Tim Berners-Lee? Well, Click reporter Anand Jagatia has been speaking to punters at London's Science Museum.
So do you know who Tim Berners-Lee is?
I have no idea, actually.
No, I don't know.
No! Oh, no! I'm doing really badly already, aren't I?
I'll give you a clue. It's got something to do with the letters WWW.
He created the internet.
He is the internet guy.
He invented the World Wide Web, and he's a member of the Order of Merit, and he's a knight.
That's probably the best answer I've had yet. What's your earliest memory of using the web?
I'm a lawyer, and being forced to change from using a quill pen to learning how to use a computer. So I'm afraid it was hard work for people like me, brought up in the old days of pen and paper.
I think playing games with my brother, like waiting for the dial-up thing.
I remember 28.8-bit modems, really slow pages, slowly drawing from the top down. Yeah, I've been using it a long time.
I actually can't remember when I first used it. It's like my kids said when I said there was no internet when I was younger. They said, "Really? And were there any cars?"
The good people of London there, speaking to Anand Jagatia. Well, some of the good people of London anyway. Let's speak to another of London's good people, actually from Brighton on the south coast. I think I have that right. Selina Godden is here.
Hello, how are you doing?
Fine, thank you. Did I get that right geographically?
No, I grew up in Hastings, which is the poor cousin at the wedding of Brighton, but I live in London.
Right, well, we've established that. You're a web user, obviously, and we should say that you are also an author and a poet. And because we're feeling very self-aggrandising here on this special edition of Click, we thought we'd mark the 25th anniversary of the web by commissioning a poem from your good self. Before we hear your poem, though, Selina, tell us about your experiences with the web. I mean, were you an early adopter?
I was the last person to get a mobile phone. So I was probably one of the last person, out of my friends, I mean, to get into the internet. I think, as a poet, I think the one thing with the internet is when you wake up in the morning and write, and you usually have a first good line, accidentally they have become tweets. So sometimes you throw away your good lines on status updates and tweets. That's the downfall of the internet, really.
And is it distracting? You might have a great line in your head, but then you just kind of wander off onto Wikipedia or something and forget what you were writing in the first place. Maybe I'm judging you by my own standards.
Well, there is always that, oh, I must look up. Yeah, there is that. I really like using online thesauruses and online, like, what's it called, Google Translate things and things like that. I like using things like that, though.
You see them as useful writer's tools.
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, I'm quite strict when I'm writing. I get up at 4 a.m. when there's nobody really going to be tweeting me back and they're just strangers I follow. So, yeah. So
that's when the interesting online conversations happen and the incredible lines of poetry as well, I'm sure.
And I now know to get up early in the morning so I can distract you by tweeting it to you, Selina, so that's even better.
Yeah. It's because you want to end up in one of Selina's poems.
I could dream of such a thing.
So, no doubt, written at 4 o'clock in the morning, we're about to hear your poem. What is its title and take it away?
The title of this poem is The Back of the Internet. I won't say any more, so I think it...
Yeah, the art will speak for itself.
Yes, I think it will. Okay. I just went round the back of the internet. I must have pressed the wrong button. Suddenly this other page came up. It was like being on the other side of a mirror, like stepping through a one-way mirror and being on the other side, looking in. I was on the inside of the other side, and you were all there, staring into your screens, You had goldfish bowl faces, glowing white and ghostly, illuminated by interwebs, and the information mines shone like gold in your glittering eyes. I grinned and waved, but you'd never see me here, not even if you used Google Earth. I just went around the back of the internet. I didn't like it, and I shan't go back. It was dimly lit by a pale, yellow, dusty old sun. The stale air smelled of wires, back tooth fillings and burnt plastic. There were no windows, word for windows. It was a ghost town, a dried-out seabed, a gritty desert wasteland. I was outside, on the other side. I found two dead wasps, not one, but two. I wondered if the wasps had been friends when they were on the other side. Then I pushed a shopping trolley about for a bit. It had a wonky wheel. I just went around the back of the internet. No one has been behind the mesh for 25 years. It was derelict and as outdated as a page of a newspaper. I took a selfie, me, on the other side, around the back of the internet, and I walked about for a bit and kicked a rock down a hole. There were no buttons to push, nothing to like or favourite, no signal. It was boring, hashtag boring, hashtag other side, retweet. I went around the back of the internet, and it was just my feet doing walking, to nowhere and into nothing and for nobody. I was on my own with my own head doing thinking, which is a bit like tweeting, but in my own head box, and on a timeline only I could read up there inside my thoughts. And I couldn't share it or change my avatar to the selfie of me, me on the other side, around the back of the internet. Then it started to water from the ceiling. Fat drops fell from a film of sky above. Well, needless to say, I didn't like that. Water falling from up there onto my actual face. Hashtag rain. I just went around the back of the internet. I won't go there again. It's all right. I'm back online now.
I just wanted to let that hang. Sina Godden. Beautiful. Thank you very much. I did not want to peer around the back of the internet after what I have heard.
The real world certainly sounds like a dangerous place, doesn't it?
No, that's kind of how I think I wrote that. That's kind of how I feel when I've been on the internet for like 10 hours and you just go to the shop to get tea bags and milk and it's a bit like that.
Yes, you're around the other side of the screen.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. And of course, some of the things you say are what the internet was like before Tim invented the web, where actually there wasn't that much to do on the internet either. The web made the internet usable for many people. So there's even a double reflection in your poem. It's a beautiful piece of work. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Agreed. And many listeners will be stunned into silence out there now, thinking the same thing, I'm sure. Sina Godden, ladies and gentlemen. So, when Tim Berners-Lee came up with the idea of the World Wide Web and his collaborators, those early web weavers, they may well have wondered what its impact was going to be eventually. Now, in beginning of the 21st century, I suppose Tim Berners-Lee is keen to get some hard data, not just anecdotes, about the impact of the web. And that's the idea behind his so-called Web Index, where he has indeed been gathering some important information.
There we were, looking at the fact that only 20% of the people in the world used the World Wide Web at all, and started this foundation to try to fix that and make the web really serve humanity. And as you talk to people, there are lots and lots of exciting stories you hear, but they're not really backed up by data. You think, oh, okay, so that was a really interesting idea, you know, story that we heard about somebody in an African village being saved by the internet in one way or another. But to what extent is that really happening? To what extent, in which countries is the internet being used? In which countries is it not? And when it isn't, why not?
And Tim, having this data now in front of all of us, does it allow you to continue, I suppose, in your mission to make the web or to encourage the web to be everything that you wanted it to be?
Well, I suppose if you look at how the web serves humanity, it's like it's a rectangle. And its height is how powerful the web is. And we've been working on, the geeks of the world have been working on making it more and more powerful all the time. We're doing that with HTML5 and the open web platform. And then, meanwhile, this is about the breadth. Well, in fact, it's about filling out the whole rectangle. So the idea of the web index is, to what extent is it actually this power being used in different places? Is it, in fact, being used in a rather weak way in lots and lots of places? Or is it being used in a powerful way in a few places or a mixture of the two? And what's, in a way, powerful about making the index is we get to choose what we put in it. So when we decide, you know, what do you mean by it being useful? Well, we said, well, it must be useful, for example, for social things. So you must be able to, so for health and education and running the country. Ideally, a democratic society will be helped by the web. So by putting these things into the index, really, we're putting them on the agenda. We're putting them on the agenda for any country which is turning around and looking at its position, wondering how to spend some money on making, on, for example, trying to manage an economic upturn, thinking, OK, now, when it comes to the internet, what do we need to do? Where are we missing out?
Tim Berners-Lee. Now, certainly over the last 10 years or so on this programme, we've been speaking quite regularly to a gentleman called Ni Narkul Quena, and he's the convener of the African Network Operations Group and also chairman of his own company, Ghana.com. And as you probably guessed, he is joining us from Ghana. So it's nice to have you back on again, Ni Narkul. And can we just talk a little bit about your views on the digital divide? It's a theme that we've spoken about a lot on the programme. Clearly, it has narrowed after 10 years, but not by enough or by pretty much what you're expecting? What are your thoughts?
Oh, I think we've made some significant progress. However, it's a very difficult challenge because even within countries, there are significant divides between the metropolitan areas and the rural areas. And naturally, among countries also, it exists. However, it is comforting to know that in the web index, the rank of, let's say, Ghana is 55, but that's in the company of some of the more technologically advanced countries like China and India. So from another, who are at 57 and 56. So it suggests to me that even though things are difficult, we have made some progress and we have made some good strides. There's still a lot more work to be done, especially in building up the capacity to do a lot more on the supply side services, and on which we therefore rely on an open and freely accessible web to accomplish that. So I am of the opinion that we have made some good progress, and perhaps even after the contributions we've made in the mobile web, we might begin to also make some contributions in the coming of Internet of Things and getting the web to be everywhere.
Is that what you see as one of the big opportunities for Africa in particular, especially in regions where, for instance, getting very high-speed broadband remains a challenge? We often hear of the leapfrogging effect that might come from mobile and indeed the mobile web.
Yes, the mobile gives us, you might say, a near-term opportunity, in the sense that while it takes some time before higher bandwidth fiber gets to every district, the mobile does indeed give ready coverage, making it possible for us to begin to integrate web-like things within our normal life. And for example, many governments now have strong infrastructure that goes from the national level to the districts for purpose of running governments. Some of the governments are even publishing open data records for the community to work with. And having such coverage makes it possible to engage a community of those who are interested in evidence-based type of work to get involved. So it does help us to get started, but it may not finish the job. We'll need higher bandwidth to accomplish a total adoption of the web.
I can certainly remember conversations over the 6 or 7 years that I've been on this programme that the web would be this enormous opportunity for many people in Africa, giving them opportunities as employees to companies outside Africa. You know, the idea that you might be an artisan and now suddenly you've got an international audience and customer base for your products. Has that ended up happening, or was that actually just a bit of a naive dream?
Oh, some of it has happened. On the other hand, it is difficult in the sense that other requirements also get in the way, and the payments is one important one. But, you know, presumably the expansion of the global internet payment solutions, that is also getting eroded, with some of our own banking systems and the switching systems also becoming more open. Opportunities are coming to address those. Subsequently, the issue of logistics in handling some of these online kinds of work functions also will need to be properly addressed. But nonetheless, I think we have made some progress in that direction, and we face the challenges. And it's not all of these things which require heavy logistics. And so we are able to continue to grow in that area as well.
Okay, well, Nia Narkor-Quayner, nice to be speaking to you again. It's always good to have you on the programme, talking to us there from Ghana. And a lot of what we've been talking about in this programme might seem quite rosy, whether it's opportunities in developing countries or indeed for the great things that we're supposed to be enjoying here in the developed West, so-called. So far, so rosy, you might say. But what about this landmark 25th anniversary? How about its timing, given that it falls amid all these rows over surveillance and censorship and the revelations from the whistleblower Ed Snowden? Snooping certainly wasn't a function that those scientists at CERN had in mind when they pored over those early blueprints of the web. Tim Berners-Lee again.
The web itself should be something you and I can use to communicate and just feel that you and I are communicating without either somebody stopping us or the feeling that we know somebody's looking over our shoulder. So the people of the world have to be constantly looking out for it. Are we going to continue on the road and just allow the governments to do more and more and more control, more and more surveillance? Or are we going to set up a bunch of values? Are we going to set up something like a Magna Carta for the World Wide Web and to say, actually, now it's so important, so much part of our lives, that it becomes on a level with human rights?
Tim Berners-Lee there. And so, Bill, obviously it's a conversation that we've had a lot in recent weeks or months. The question is, can these be reconciled? We want the web to be free, but at the same time we probably need certain controls.
The technology in itself doesn't dictate or determine how it's used. The web was built to be open, and as Tim said there, we want an open platform that carries a price. And the price is constant vigilance, all different areas of it. It's not just something you put out there and then say, OK, now the web's there, we just live with it. The fact is we have to pay attention. It's a bit like democracy. You know, democracy isn't something you just do and then forget about. Well, an open web isn't just something you do and then forget about. So you then do need to balance individual cases, individual freedoms, to see how they will work on this open platform that's been created.
And Selena Godden, we'll finish with you, and it's a simple one, really. What would you say has been the biggest surprise for you then in these years that you've been on the web? I know you weren't necessarily an early adopter, but things must have come along on the way, behind the internet, as it were, that might have taken you aback.
Oh, well, obviously, crowdfunding and the way we publish books and the way that people can share poetry and music, I think it's just revolutionised that. And I think it's just wonderful that we can just hear so much music and so many different voices now. So,
okay, yeah. Well, Selena Godden, thank you very much indeed for that. And of course to Bill Thompson as ever. We'll be back with a regular programme. I'm sure we'll be talking about lots of stuff related to the web, because you can't exactly not on the technology programme that is called Click, when it is produced by Colin Grant and presented by me, Gareth Mitchell. Thanks for listening and goodbye. Just because you have been kind enough, dear listener, to download the podcast for this programme over the World Wide Web, then we're going to talk at you for another few minutes.
They might not have used the World Wide Web, actually, because the podcast comes via RSS, really simple syndication, or other ways of distributing it that are not necessarily based around HTTP.
Which brings an important distinction to light, isn't it? Because obviously the World Wide Web isn't the internet. Even I know that, but clearly the subtleties of RSS versus HTML had been lost on me.
No. It's good to mash them all together
Hang
in normal
on,
conversation.
I don't know the difference between those two.
Shall we ask Bill what the difference is?
Yeah, come on, Bill. What is the difference?
Bill, what's the difference?
Between Tinternet.
Tinternet and
I mean, I'm looking at Bill as if I know the answer. It's just to help the listeners here.
Yeah. The internet is all the computers connected together over this network, this interconnected network that links them all, and lots of traffic, lots of data moves. The web is a particular application that uses the internet, though could use other networks, and when it was originally developed by Tim Berners-Lee, did use other networks, including one called DECnet, to move structured information around between a web server and a web browser. So the data stored on the server comes to you over the internet where it's displayed in your browser. So like email is a way of using the internet, the web is a way of using the internet.
Okay.
But not the World Wide Web in the case of email, unless you've got an HTML browser.
I'm just going to keep nodding.
That's
at
what
this
I
point.
Do
yeah,
a lot.
Just nod. Yeah. Is that what you not, do? Yeah. Hanging out with Bill.
It's a difference.
Not with
between,
that. I knew that already. Face. That's what I tend to do.
Yeah, of course.
The difference between the rail tracks and the trains.
Okay,
that's good.
So you can run goods trains or passenger trains, or if you want one of those little things where you push up and down yourself over the rail tracks. Rail tracks just connect things together.
And some of them are like storage trains.
Exactly. Okay. They're all different sorts of trains. The web is a type of train. Email's another type of train.
And some of them have got trains with bars
where you
can get a beer.
The good ones have trains with bars.
Yeah, we like those ones.
The Web is a train with the best cocktail bar in the world.
Okay, good. Let's go.
John Marston knows all about the distinction between the web and the internet. He says his first experience of the, in inverted commas, internet, manually routing emails using UUCP, concentrating on routing nodes with exclamation marks, is my earliest memory, says John Marston, possibly predating the web, though.
It definitely predated the web, because when I was at Acorn Computers in about 1986, my email address had bangs in it as well, exclamation marks in it as well. And, of course, it was reversed as well, so it was uk.co.acorn, not... acorn.co.uk.
I think I remember that, yeah. Tim Kirby says, remember Netscape, remember Trumpet Windsock? That was how I first surfed the web on a Windows PC. Gordon Jolly, who we happen to know, he says around 1993 at UCL. He says, I also sent Bill Thompson a message from there when he was on The Big Bite, which is a radio programme that went out on BBC Radio 5 Live, the domestic radio network, on Sundays.
That's right. We had some very good people working on The Big Bite. They were really young, though. They were young and keen and enthusiastic. I believe one of them was called Gareth Mitchell.
Yeah, there was a particularly star producer in those days. I think you'll find there, Selena, before I move to this side of the glass where I can do a bit less damage, I think. Sanket Dingra, this is a brilliant one, says, started back in 2005. The internet was starting to penetrate our homes in India back then, and I wanted to get onto the bandwagon. I used to go to a cafe to get to know the internet, checking mail, surfing my way through. Today, that same internet has amalgamated itself so well into our lives that I'm posting this sitting in my bed, on my phablet. How far we've come, I think you'll find there.
Really?
Great anecdote from Sanket.
And yet the use of the word phablet. So we haven't come that far, really.
Oh, you had to go and spoil it, Bill, didn't you? But hey, you did a whole train metaphor thing, so that's good by me,
as
I'm sure it will be for many listeners.
Yeah.
There you go. Good. Well, Colin's been a much firmer producer than I ever was, and he's saying wrap it up. So that is it. That was the podcast, indeed, and outro. And we'll have more of your stories about the internet and World Wide Web next week in the podcast intro and outro to this programme. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.